Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest edition of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. I'm Rob Farley, and here with me today are Paul Campos and Scott Lemieux. How are you guys doing today?
Very well. As good as can be expected under the circumstances, so bad.
A more honest answer.
So we are recording this podcast at 4 p.m. Eastern on Wednesday the 13th, and hopefully you guys will be listening to it at around the same time, because we're hoping to get this up soon. But this is a historic day in American politics, because it will almost certainly see the first time in history that a president has been impeached twice during his only term. And so I guess just to toss this out, have you guys been paying attention to the impeachment proceedings, or basically what's going down in Washington, D.C. right now?
Yes. I've been following it, and I've watched some of the speechification, and I've done a lot of reading about the whole history of the process and so forth in the last few days, because I've been opining on it ever since I got sucked into this 25th Amendment side of things. So, I've been following it.
All right. And Scott, you haven't had any power, but have you been able to?
Yeah, I've only been able just kind of on, you know, because obviously I've been, I haven't had power all day until about 10 minutes ago. So I've been sort of trying to conserve, tablet and phone. So I've basically been having to follow on Twitter and that. So I only have a vague sense of what's going on. I thought this podcast was going to be about NHL opening day. So, you know, it does seem to be the overwhelming consensus that the, there hasn't been a lot of variety in the debate in the House of Representatives, that, you know, sort of the Democrats are making a persuasive case that inciting violent insurrection against the government is bad. And Republicans are arguing that it's, you know, cancel culture to, bring this up at all. And then also my favorite argument that the only legitimate way sanction against a president is the ballot box, which isn't a great argument to begin with, given that I don't have the secret Federalist Society Constitution, but my copy has the impeachment remedy in it. But in addition to that, the House Republicans making that argument, the vast majority of them voted to throw out the results of that election just last week. So I think my favorite example of this was Jim Jordan, who I don't think he goes a sentence without using the phrase cancel culture, introduced a resolution last night to prevent Democrats from saying mean things about President Trump. I'm beginning to question the good faith of Jim Jordan's commitment to free speech. But sound cynical.
What surprised me the most was that the secret copy of the Federalist Society's Constitution, in fact, included a clause saying that Mike Pence could overturn the election results, right? That one was really out of left field and was quite surprising. All right, so Paul, of course, you've been following, and you know, you've been following the technical details based on the 25th Amendment stuff, but also the impeachment. So what are we going to be looking at in the next 7 days, right? What's going to be happening, or what do you guys think is going to be happening, or think is going to happen in the next 7 days as we shamble to the end of this administration?
Well, the critical question is, what will the House leadership do with the bill of impeachment, which is certainly going to be voted out, and it's in fact being voted on at this very moment? Will they send it immediately to the Senate, or will they hold on to it? There's certainly been quite a bit of discussion about the possibility that they might not refer it to the Senate for quite a while to allow there to be some comprehensive investigations of the January 6th insurrection, since more and more information keeps coming out that keeps making that insurrection look worse and worse, and which is increasingly implicating various members of Congress as being involved either tangentially or possibly quite directly in the events. So I think that will be the first question that faces the Democrats, because McConnell has now made it clear that he's not going to cooperate with any kind of early referral. And so the earliest that the trial could begin would be the day before the inauguration, which means that the Democrats have to make the judgment, should they have a trial immediately, when they have the first few days of Joe Biden's administration dominated by that, or should they wait a few months and allow the process to play out on the investigative level before actually having the trial in the Senate. For what it's worth, I think the latter option is probably the better one at this point.
I see, in addition to being able to compile a better case for impeachment, the other advantage of this is that my view is that the Senate should, you know, pass a robust relief package that includes a lot of money for vaccination and state and local aid and so on, whether that's as a reconciliation bill or, because I believe we have two reconciliation bills. So it seems to me that, you know, and I don't know if obstructing that is one reason McConnell has signaled an openness to voting to convict. But either way, it strikes me as more important to get that done as soon as, you know, because that isn't, you know, especially when it comes to getting vaccines into arms, you know, the sooner the better. And there's really a lot of ground to be made up on. So my preference would be get that done first. And then move on to impeachment. And then again, that also gives you the additional advantage of being able to build a better case. You know, and again, I still think that we're just scratching the surface of what we know about, you know, that there's basically no detail coming out of 1/6 that makes things sound better. You know, essentially every day has information that's just more frightening. You know, and particularly now that we, you know, the Paul blogged about this last night, but the potential collaboration of House Republicans with the insurrectionists. You know, so, you know, I think that I think that waiting a little so that we have, you know, now I do find Glenn Greenwald's, you know, taking the bare assertions of parlor executives pretty convincing. But, you know, we still may want to wait for, you know, more evidence to emerge simply because I think that if we go ahead, we're going to be leaving a lot of things off the table. So I think that for a variety of reasons, I agree with Paul that it would be prudent to wait, get the relief bill done first. Do further investigations. You know, since he can't be removed from office, it's just about his, you know, his pension and his ability to run for office again and so on. At that point, I think we're better. You know, I think the play to McConnell should be either let us do it now or, you know, we're going to wait a few months. That's right.
And
right.
Another detail not to overlook here is that it's not just 1/6. I mean, there's a huge amount of stuff about the Trump administration that we don't know at this point. It's often difficult to remember that that's the case because what we do know is so horrible that there's just sort of a psychological assumption that what we don't know can't really be very significant. But that, of course, is not true at all. And so the various scandals that are going to come tumbling out of the post-Trump period as people start talking and as people start getting indicted and as people start pleading out, et cetera, I think could build a case in a few months where Trump's conviction in the Senate would be quite possible. So that's, you know, yet another reason, I think, to extend this process. And a third reason, or perhaps I should say a related reason, is that the longer the Republicans can be tortured with this, the better. And there's no reason not to take a real series of sort of astounding scandals and treat them like the Republicans treated all the fake scandals that they supposedly discovered during the Obama administration.
Right. So, I mean, my priorities on this have been that impeachment was a really important thing to have. And it's very important that the House return articles of impeachment, because, of course, there's only a week left, but President Trump can still engage in enormously destructive behavior over the next 7 days. And so and some of that destructive behavior might, in fact, be enough to either A, trigger Mike Pence's 25th Amendment, or if Vice President Pence is unwilling to do that, then to trigger a quick impeachment a quick Senate trial and a removal. Now, it seems, as we've been saying, that McConnell is not looking towards going ahead and doing that. But I think we can agree there are probably things that Trump could do in the next 3 or 4 days that would change Mitch's mind, right? And so it's nice to have that in the back pocket. Now, beyond that, it seems to me that an impeachment accomplishes two major things for the Republic. One, I mean, it restores the dignity of the office and restores the dignity of the Republic, and also it disqualifies Trump in the future. And both of those seem to me to be things that can last or that can wait until after 100 days. That there are the legislative priorities and the priorities associated with putting Joe Biden's people into the cabinet, and And I think the people have been a little too quick in terms of assuming how rapidly those things could happen in the Senate, right? Even with Democratic control, there are norms that are associated with cabinet appointments and the vetting of cabinet appointments that are part of the Senate responsibility. And so those things are going to take up a lot of time in the first 100 days, as is any discussion of relief bills and horse trading and all of that sort of things. And so pushing back impeachment past that 100 days seems to me to be a fantastic idea. And if the House can do that through a procedural move that would be to hold on to the articles until later, that seems fantastic. It's interesting, sort of, Paul, what you brought up in terms of, you know, what we are going to find when we open the books on this administration, because it opens up this question of, you know, what exactly does the Constitution say about a late impeachment? I know we had just talked about this a little, but that seems to me to be almost a convincer in terms of, it seems determinative and decisive in terms of being able to argue that late impeachment, which is to say impeachment late in a term or after a presidential term has passed, is actually something which should be constitutionally enabled, right? Normatively, we would want it to be, because there's lots of horrible things that a president can do that don't become apparent or that we don't have a considerable amount of evidence into until after that president leaves office, right? And so it seems almost a clincher in terms that we should be leaning towards an interpretation that enables the Senate to convict a president and to proceed with certain kinds of punishments, including disqualification, even well after that president has no longer been in office.
Yes, that's true. Now, it is important to acknowledge that the constitutional situation is quite murky on this, because we have almost no precedents. One doesn't have to be too cynical to speculate that the Federalist Society gangsters who dominate so much of the federal judiciary at present may not see things the same way. This does, however, raise the, in my view, somewhat delightful possibility that the Republicans may not actually know one way or the other whether Donald Trump is actually eligible to run for president by the time 2024 rolls around. And that could lead to, a rather complex situation. Here, I just want to throw in one note. A plain reading of the former President's Act would seem to indicate that Trump would not lose his benefits under it, even if he is convicted, because the plain language of the statute says that the benefits will be withheld from someone who is removed from office under the impeachment clauses. And that would not seem to apply to Trump. But on the other hand, Congress could, by a simple majority vote, pass legislation which would strip Trump of his post-presidential benefits.
No, I think one thing we're going to see is a lot of people try to make claims that the Constitution has definitive answers about something that it very clearly doesn't. And in particular, it's going to be when you're dealing with Article 2, which was, sort of hastily written in about a day, very little, the Constitution does not clearly answer the question of whether, impeachment and conviction could be applied to somebody after they leave office. The way I would look at it is that if the Constitution doesn't clearly say that it can't, then we should defer to Congress. As Paul says, unfortunately, I do not have the median vote on any federal appellate court, so that's not perhaps terribly relevant. That seems to me to be the obvious right answer. Can I say that the Constitution definitively answers that question? I cannot. It's essentially something that you have to make, structural inferences about. And just sort of the situation we're in is that, particularly, that they're just a lot, the Constitution came together very quickly, and just leaves a lot of gaps and ambiguities, and this is one of them. I don't think that we have a definitive answer to this. I do want to say, by the way, that one thing I hate about the January 6th events is that it really buried what an extraordinarily historic accomplishment it was for Democrats to take back the Senate. And we wouldn't be having these conversations about McConnell if we don't win both the Georgia runoffs. I think that in addition to giving us power, I think that it also said something about Trumpism and its effect on the Republican Party that pretty clearly has spooked McConnell and a lot of other Senate Republicans. That was just it's almost impossible to overstate how important that is. Not only in that, economic, relief would be off the table, resources to do the vaccinations quick would be off the table, but also that it sort of shows that, there was an actual price for Republican elites embracing Trump. And one of those prices is control of the United States Senate. Stephen Breyer can be replaced. Federal vacancies can be placed. That's really huge. And it really just got blown out of the water. It's particularly striking given the number of people who just took for granted based on history that this was impossible. And I think it's also important in that what Stacey Abrams did, and I'm not trying to deny her any credit, seems replicable. It's not like some magic trick. I mean, it seems what is done in Georgia can theoretically be done in North Carolina if things get a little bit closer in Texas. I mean, Florida, I just sort of assume is voodoo and we're just going to lose that by 2 points every year until we all die. But outside of that, I think that this is. So I think that that's really important for a lot of ways. But I think most importantly, we wouldn't even be talking about the possibility of convicting Trump had we not won those runoffs. So I did want to say that it's too bad that the events of 1-6 have really sort of masked what an extraordinary accomplishment that was.
I would like to note for the record that I just got a text notification that Trump has now been impeached. And although voting is not complete, the threshold has been reached. And to this point, 9 Republicans have voted to impeach.
Yeah, my text says 10. So this is actually something that I wanted to probe with you guys. So it looks like 10 to 194 with respect to the Republican caucus in the House voted to convict. How do you guys read the difference between the Senate and the House on this point, right? Because we know that, in fact, there is on January 6th itself, that something like more than half of the people who had in the Senate who had been expected to join the protest, the Holly Cruz protest, did not do so, while their House colleagues overwhelmingly stayed on message in terms of joining the protest. And of course, if impeachment is to be successful in terms of delivering a conviction, whether within or outside of Trump's term, you're going to need a lot more than 10. Well, 10 in the House, you're going to need at least 17 in the Senate in order to be able to convict. So how do you guys read? I mean, I understand why Mitch is more angry about this than sort of your common House backbencher, right? I mean, Mitch is someone who has only ever aspired to control of the Senate. He's never wanted to be president, right? And so the indignity visited upon the Senate is something that's easy for me to understand why he's upset about. But what do you guys take away from this in terms of the difference between how the House GOP thinks and how the Senate GOP thinks about impeachment and conviction?
Well, I think the Senate GOP is not as radicalized as the House GOP just because of the structure of the Senate, it being statewide voting. So it's only gerrymandered to the extent that the states are gerrymandered, which is, of course, not inconsiderable. But it's a quite different situation from the structure of the House. Senators have more latitude, I think, for a variety of reasons. Scott has no doubt a better sense of these things than I do. I think probably the more critical factor here will be that it is likely that Trump's political capital is going to be much lower a few months from now than it is at present. I think this is just speculative on my part, but the combination of a constant stream of incredibly damning stories about him coming out after his presidency, as various canaries sing, and also the very natural effect that when someone isn't in power anymore, I mean, you get the King Lear effect, basically, right? Donald Trump can terrorize people now in all sorts of ways. He becomes a much more equivocal figure in all sorts of ways in 7 days. All of that, I think, leads me to conclude, for what it's worth, that the odds of getting 67 senators to convict Trump are going to be actually pretty decent, probably, a few months from now. Just because both of the structural politics of the Senate, but also of just the way the news and more broadly history is going to unfold.
Yeah, I mean, it was really, I forget, maybe it was Tim Albert, I forget who said that, you know, the House Republicans are very fortunate that Hawley and Cruz are so extraordinarily obnoxious and disliked by everybody, and that it's really detracted attention from just how absolutely insane House Republicans are. And you could really see that after the attacks, that, you know, when Kelly Loeffler spoke, kind of withdrawing her her joining of the Hawley Cruz sedition vote, she seemed legitimately shaken. And this is a, you know, pretty, you know, standard issue, you know, sociopathic plutocrat. And she just seemed legitimately shaken by the events. And, you know, I don't think she was acting, you know, and which is, I think, how any rational person would act to a marauding mob coming through your place of work and going after you. And then to contrast that with House Republicans who just didn't care at all and weren't affected by that. It really is striking. You know, again, I think that part of that is, you know, that there's always been this structural element that senators representing statewide constituencies, you know, just are more prominent, you know, that they're often in districts that aren't quite as safe. And obviously, you know, Loeffler can speak to that. But there's also just seems to be a cultural thing. You know, frankly, most Republican senators also have, you know, pretty ironclad safe seats. And yet that there wasn't, you know, that they did seem to react to this very differently than House Republicans do. And that's partly just seems to be a general cultural thing. You know, I can't even really fully explain it. But I think one issue is that, you know, senators are more likely to have presidential ambitions, which I think complicates what they have to think. You know, I wonder if part of what's going on is that, and my understanding is that Tom Cotton, you know, actually played a pretty significant role in reducing support, that him coming out against the Hawley Cruz strategy actually kind of stopped the landslide. I wonder if one thing going on is that Cotton is smart enough to realize that, like, no Ivy League dork is winning the Republican nomination if Trump runs, whereas Howley's arrogant enough not to understand that. You know, that may be too simplistic, but that I think one thing Mitch McConnell absolutely understands is that it's really not in the interest of Republicans for Donald Trump to be the nominee. And I think he also understands that it's going to be extremely difficult to beat Trump if he's the nominee. And as Paul has said, I think there are a lot of people who are in denial about Trump running, in part because they're under the impression that health outcomes are primarily driven by personal choices rather than genetics. But, you know, there seems to be every reason to think that if he's eligible, Trump will run again. If not Trump, you know, perhaps, you know, a family member or some, you know, similar relative. And it's just very difficult for sort of any kind of ordinary Republican politician to compete with that. So I think that there's going to be some, you know, but I think senators kind of have to pay attention to that. Whereas, you know, Jim Jordan is not going to be the presidential nominee and he knows it. So he just doesn't have to care. So I think that that's part of what's going on here.
Yeah, I agree with all that, but I do think that it's important not to underestimate the extent to which the Republican Party is going truly insane all the way down. The combination of psychosis and just sheer sort of complete lack of any kind of moral grounding will lead, I think, for a sort of race to the bottom type competition in the 2024 presidential nomination campaign. And I think what we'll see is a bunch of people attempting to out Trump Trump. You know, I think Steve Allen once said that, you know, imitation is the sincerest form of television. And that, I think, applies to politics as well. I would not be shocked, really, if we end up getting somebody who is almost unimaginably crazy right now to be the Republican nominee in 2024, if it isn't actually Trump, who will, of course, be much crazier by 2024 than he is now. I mean, Lauren Boebert could be the nominee. that's the direction we've been going in. I mean, of course, people say, oh, come on, that's just completely insane. But of course, electing Donald Trump president was completely insane.
Hey, so we're going to replay this pod if that happens. We're going to replay this pod so we have the soundbite there. We can blame you for it, Paul, if she ends up being the nominee.
That's right. Well, you know, I merely foretell. Okay? I'm not actually producing any of this. But it's just an utterly extraordinary time. I myself have really no confidence that the American political system isn't in the process of fairly rapid disintegration. For the entire Trump presidency, I've been wondering about the application of Juan Linz's, the political scientist's critique of presidential systems. I'm sure Scott's familiar with this, you know, the perils of presidentialism, the idea essentially being that presidential systems are not capable of maintaining anything like the necessary level of stability when you have ideologically coherent parties that are battling to establish themselves as the voice of the people, as it were, since you have this fundamental conflict between the executive and the legislative in a presidential system. And, you know, when Linz wrote that article 30 years ago, now he explained the relative exceptionalism of the United States in this regard compared to, say, Latin America, on the basis of the fact that America didn't have, for the most part, or hadn't had, for the most part, really well-disciplined, ideologically coherent parties. But now that we do, it doesn't really seem to be working out, as it were. So I'm just throwing that out there as something that, you know, we might want to continue to sort of think about.
And we can see this in both of our current home states, is that one really interesting phenomenon is that, you know, that we, you know, and Washington made this transition a little earlier than Colorado, and Colorado was, you know, more, you know, Republican than Washington generally was. But, you know, we were, you know, as recently as 10 years ago, statewide elections in Washington were decided by razor-thin margins. And, you know, Colorado was, if anything, a red-leaning state. What's interesting is that as Republicans have become the minority party, rather than sort of moderating and trying to remain competitive, they've just completely given up on winning state. I mean, there is literally Washington Secretary of State is the only Republican to hold statewide office on the entire West Coast. You know, so that rather than, you know, saying, well, you know, we need to go back to the center to try to win, they're just accepting permanent minority status. Part of that is what, you know, Iglesias talked about recently about how Republicans sort of going crazier while also having no real policy agenda, or at least no policy agenda that isn't carried out by the courts. So it's this really strange thing that it's not even clear what they want power to do. You know, that once the tax cuts were passed, you know, they had unified government for another year, basically didn't do anything. You know, so there's this sort of weird thing in which there's just, you know, the insane people also don't really want to accomplish anything. And so what normally you would expect is that in the, you know, Colorado and Washington and Virginia and these states where they've just lost enormous amounts of support, they should logically be moderating to try to be competitive. And instead, if anything, they're doubling down and moving the opposite direction. You know, our gubernatorial election, the Republican candidate was like a you know, pale copy of Trump, who still hasn't conceded, is still filing lawsuits, is still leading anti-mask rallies. You know, it's a very strange phenomenon. And I don't even know, I can't even really fully explain it, because, you know, I actually agree with the Linz approach, and I think that there are serious problems with presidentialism. But there's also just this willingness of Republicans to just, you know, permanently give up on trying to compete in places where they could theoretically be competitive. It just seems to be a unique thing. And that, I think, is what you're seeing reflected in the House, is that there's just really, you know, that every incentive for advancement within the Republican Party is to just, you know, be as crazy as possible, and it's not even really important that you control anything or accomplish anything.
I think what there's a very, very pernicious symbiotic relationship here between the Republican Party and the right-wing media structure, because, you know, Scott points out quite correctly that there seems to be a distinct lack of interest on the part of elected Republicans to actually do much in the way of governmental policy beyond tax cuts. But there is an extremely strong appetite among elected Republicans to make a huge amount of money in the right-wing screamosphere if they can raise their profile high enough to get like a Fox News gig and potentially become the next Sean Hannity or Laura Ingraham or what have you. That's how I understand somebody like Lauren Boebert. I mean, part of it is that she's obviously insane, but another part of it is that she wants to be a Fox News star. I mean, that's her goal in life. It's not to enact certain kinds of policy changes or anything like that. Because, I mean, you know, relatedly, the only policy change that the Republicans at this point really want is to construct a time machine that takes this country back to 1950. That's what they actually want. And they want a country that looks like America looked like in 1950. And I don't think that there is enough general appreciation of how much demographic change has taken place in the United States over the lifetimes of people like Donald Trump and Joe Biden. Let me just quote a couple statistics here. In 1950, the Hispanic population of the United States was 2.3%, and the majority of those people considered themselves white, and the vast majority of them were located in two states. The Asian American population of the United States was negligible. It was far less than 1%, and it was all located in two states. Then you had 11% of the national population being African American, most of it still in the Deep South. And then the rest of the country was just white. And, you know, there are vast portions of the United States that were completely white, where there wasn't anyone who was that would be a sort of recognizable ethnic minority, even by the standards of the time, which, of course, had a much sort of looser understanding of what counted as an ethnic minority. That's what the Republicans really want. That's what they want. They want that even more than they want tax cuts.
There's a contradiction right there, because they certainly don't want the tax policy of 1950, right? Policy in 1950, they would rather have the tax policy in now than the tax policy in 1950.
By the way, here, I just want to mention, this is actually a point which is a little bit to the side of what we're talking about, but I really want to emphasize it because it happens to be something that I've been studying in another context. You hear Republicans lie all the time about what the tax situation in the 1950s actually is. It's just standard policy on the part of Heritage and Cato and people like that to say, well, yes, marginal rates were much higher than the 1950s, but there were so many deductions, loopholes, et cetera, that rich people didn't actually pay higher taxes than they do today. That's completely false. I've looked at the effect of tax rates for what people paid in the United States in the 1950s compared to today. And as a percentage of total income, which is what effective tax is, rich people in the United States in the 1950s were paying double what they're paying today as an effective tax rate. The tax rates really were vastly higher. I mean, they were so much higher that if you recommended anything even vaguely like in the direction of the tax code during the Eisenhower administration, you'd be considered, you know, a literal communist.
Right.
Yeah, I hope someday we can get Rick Perlstein on, because, you know, the last of his conservatism series is really good about the development of, you know, it's really under the Carter administration where corporate America got really politicized and radicalized, leading us to where we are now. Incidentally, my favorite detail about Lauren Boebert, about her being authentically crazy, is that she was a witness to her husband exposing his penis to three women in a bowling alley. And then getting incredibly belligerent when asked to leave. So she was one of the people who gave a statement to the police. They were not dating at the time. She started dating him after that incident. So I think that is pretty much tells you that she's not acting. She's legitimately nuts.
So just to project, and first I want to say there's a pretty profound distinction between where you guys are right now in Colorado. I believe that later this afternoon, the supermajorities in the Kentucky House and Senate will probably make the Democratic Party illegal. They'll be able to, override, seven different kinds of veto that the Democratic governor can put in. So that's where we are in Kentucky. So you mentioned the primaries a little bit, and I think it's worth looking forward to what 2022 and 2024 are going to look like. 2024 we talked about, and is sort of interesting because Hawley and Cruz, for just to toss out to individuals at random, would benefit enormously from President Trump not being on the ballot in 2024. And at the same time, they have to vote against his conviction, right, in order to appeal. And so that's some very interesting game theory that's going to be going on for those two gentlemen. But just projecting not 4 years forward, but just 2 years forward, my major concern and my thinking in terms of the distinction between the House and the Senate was that what we're seeing right now is House representatives essentially posturing themselves for the GOP primaries in 2 years against senators who did not vote for the protest. And so, you know, what we're looking forward in 2022 is going to be a lot of primary challenges for senators who did not, Republican senators who did not pursue the Trump line as vigorously as they could. And then it's going to be from people in the House who voted against the second impeachment and who voted for the electoral challenge, right? So you have a lot of people still anticipating that Trump is going to be their ticket to a Senate seat in 2 years. I mean, that's kind of my interpretation. I'm curious what you guys think about that.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, although, again, with the caveat that we don't know what's going to come out in the next few months.
Right.
Sorry.
I was just going to say it's possible that what may come out could actually make Trump radioactive in terms of anybody seeking statewide office in the United States or even in Alabama.
Yeah, and certainly, you know, this does seem to have, you know, that on the one hand, this does seem to have decreased his approval ratings. On the other hand, you know, by a shockingly small margin. Although, again, that, you know, there's a couple of interesting dynamics here. Is that first of all, is that you know, Republicans have, you know, the remarkable ability to you know, deplatform people you know, they used to worship. I mean, people forget. I think it was a Chater made this point recently, but like, you know, George W. Bush was basically treated as a literal god by Republican intelligentsia. Like, basically every editor at the National Review wrote a book about how, you know, Bush was the greatest president in American history. And by like 2009, it was like he never existed. Like, Republican orthodoxy is basically that the last Republican president, you know, left office in 1989. You know, and so, you know, it's sort of a very interesting dynamic in that, you know, I suspect Republican elites are going to want to do this again. And that's what McConnell's signaling. Only, you know, Trump has a much more personal connection to Republican voters than George W. Bush did. So, you know, I'm not sure it can be accomplished as easily, but I think it's a very interesting phenomenon. Or what if, you know, the another important incident here is Trump complaining to Rupert Murdoch after Fox News called Arizona and Uncle Rupert telling Trump to eat shit. You know, if, you know, Rupert Murdoch turns on Trump and decides he's no longer good for business, you know, can he control his personalities? You know, can a new narrative be created? It's very interesting. I think there's something else going on here, too, which is that we would assume that the midterm elections would be disastrous for the in party. But a couple of things have changed. Is that, first of all, is that the changing demographics of the parties mean that, you know, it's not obvious that Democrats are at a disadvantage in lower turnout elections. The Democratic electorate is now more educated, more high turnout voters. You know, so I forget who made this point recently, but like the Democratic wine mums are going to be there in 2022. It's not obvious that, you know, the people in the Rio Grande Valley who voted for Trump for the first time are showing up in midterms in 2022. So it is actually, and the Senate map for Democrats actually isn't bad in the upcoming midterms. So it's actually interesting to see, you know, and again, I'm sort of naturally inclined to be pessimistic, and I especially think that holding on to the House is going to be really difficult. But combined with, you know, the Democrats getting more kind of high turnout constituencies and the fact that, you know, Schumer and Biden consider, you know, a stimulus substantially bigger than the ARRA too small, you know, does seem like, Democratic elites are finally starting to figure out that austerity only helps Republicans. And nobody cares about deficits. So, you know, that could mean that we're heading into the midterms with, like, you know, robust economic growth and more favorable demographics, plus, you know, whatever comes out about Trump hurting the Republican brand. So I think it's going to be very interesting to see how it plays out. But there may be a little, you know, at least some reason to believe that this isn't going to be a complete disaster like 2010 was.
Yeah, it'll be fascinating if we hold on to the Senate and lose the House. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some evidence that Trump, although he is extremely energizing to both the Republican and the Democratic bases when he's on the ticket, to the extent that he actually ran somewhat behind most Republicans in this last election, it appears from the 2018 election that the effect of him suppressing turnout among hardcore Republican believers when he's not on the ballot is even stronger. And so the fact that he won't be on the ballot in 2022 certainly may actually redound more to the Democrats' favor than the contrary. And so I agree with Scott that it's difficult to say with much confidence exactly how 2022 is likely to shake out, just because it's such a weird time in American politics, and also, of course, more generally with the COVID, pandemic catastrophe and the playing out of that as well. So, I think it's going to be a really interesting sort of post-Trump hangover period, especially because we don't even know, of course, whether it's going to be genuinely post-Trump in any sort of sustained kind of way. We may look back to right now, 3 years from now, and think that things are relatively stable and sane in comparison to where they have gotten in 2024. I can easily imagine Trump being the front runner for a nomination that he's not eligible to win.
That's a horrifying thought. So we only have about five more minutes. And so I want to close out with a final question right here. And so is Twitter's decision to suspend President Trump's Twitter account, is this the most authoritarian violation of civil liberties in American history or in the entire arc of human history? So which of those two do you think is true?
Well, I think we really need to ask Space Milk, Glenn Greenwald, about that. Because I'm sure he has a very, very well-considered view on that, if we can pluck him off whatever Rio Beach he's currently sock puppeting from.
Well, look, I think the greatest violation of free speech in history were those Oberlin students who said that, a bologna sandwich on Wonder Bread shouldn't be called a banh mi. So I think we should just stipulate that. But, this could be number two. I just don't see. It's one of those things where, the Greenwalds and Tracy of the world are making arguments that like nobody could possibly believe. I don't think anybody literally believes that a media company has to host, whatever content can be put out there. And if we assume that media companies can have some terms of service, I don't see how Trump didn't violate them. I think inciting violence, and this is even the most libertarian, conception of the First Amendment holds that speech can be prosecuted when it's brigaded with action, and fighting words are exactly, where that is reached. And in addition to that, I just don't see any defense for the claim that Twitter is a monopoly. It's just not, it's amusing when people, make that argument from their Substack and their, 50 in their Medium and everything else. And by the way, when I said earlier that that Greenwald said that Parler, that nobody involved in the riots used Parler, and his only evidence for that were the assertions of Parler executives, that is literally true. he tweeted that, and we now have GPS data showing that Parler played a huge role, not only in fomenting the attacks, but in carrying them out. And I really, I should try to, again, I haven't had Power for a long time, but I've been meaning to blog. The Wall Street Journal had a remarkable article yesterday showing that, the mob was in some cases like 60 seconds away from being around legislators. It was just an incredibly close call. I don't think we fully grasped how much worse this could have very easily been. And really, without the contingent acts of courage of a few Capitol Police officers, this could have been just an unimaginable catastrophe. And it seems pretty clear that these sites played a major role in carrying it out. And again, I don't see any argument that Amazon Web Service, and again, Amazon Web Service is just not a fucking monopoly. It's just not. I'm sorry. it is not the only company. And it's just, I'm sorry, if your brand is so toxic that one of the many companies that can host websites doesn't want to host yours, that's capitalism, my friend. And I just don't see what you know, I'm just not seeing that. But certainly to talk about this, and again for Josh Howley, you know, who's a Yale law educated person, to claim that, you know, the First Amendment means that a publisher has to publish whatever manuscript they send them. I mean, you know, it's just silly. But
I think this is maybe a topic for another discussion. But something that I've been wanting to write about is what I think these kinds of arguments illustrate is what I would call like the degree of sort of intellectual degeneracy and licentiousness that essentially dominates the right and the pseudo left right now in the United States. In other words, the fact that you can just say things that make absolutely no sense, either empirically or logically, and just say them over and over again, and they can be effective as a matter of rhetoric because we live in a culture in which people can just say things like Josh Hawley said about him being censored by Simon & Schuster. This reminds me of such a famous statement about the anti-Semite, you know, that the anti-Semite is just smiling when you make arguments with him because he doesn't argue in good faith. So why are you even arguing with him? Well, I mean, what applies to anti-Semites, I think applies to the entire right wing in the United States, and also to people like Hawley and who is of course part of the right wing, but also all these fake leftists who are supposedly they're cosplaying Herbert Marcuse or something while they're defending Hawley and Cruz and the like. So, I mean, I think that is a topic worth returning to.
Yeah, I think we could do an entire podcast about that, and there's no reason why we shouldn't. All right, so we are at just about the end of our time. Do either of you guys have any quick closing remarks?
No, thank you.
Yeah, I would just I just blogged about it, but I do want to acknowledge just how appalling it is that Trump is ending his lame duck tenure by executing a bunch of people, one of them who didn't kill anybody, and another just a woman who spent her teenage years, you know, being, you know, horribly tortured and sexually assaulted. It really is instructive. And again, this isn't just Trump. You know, this is something where, you know, elite Republican lawyers are putting an enormous amount of time and effort, as is the Republican Supreme Court. So I do think that the events of 1/6 are sort of allowing that to happen under the radar, but I hope that will start to get more attention. And I do think that it's one of the underrated things about Joe Biden is that he's an explicit opponent of the death penalty, which is a nice thing to have in a president of the United States.
Right. So I do think that we can return to that and that we should in the near future. So let me thank both of you, Scott and Paul, and let me thank all of our listeners. And we will be back to you soon to continue this discussion because the stuff is still happening out there. Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of the Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of the Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again.